I'm surprised someone hasn't figured out the formula for where the taxes that you pay equal the services that you get. So you adjust your income, you know. I mean, the people who are frugal will go to great expense to save money, you know, or to feel that they're, right, they're not paying for more than they get, and they're not, so you could, there must be some break-even point, right?
Yeah, but how would we?
You'd have to
be so many factors.
You'd have to divide groups of services. You'd fit into, and maybe a whole menu of services, and you say, well, this one affects me, this one, this one, this one, this one, and you add up the total, and you see that, and it says if you pay more than this much in tax, you're subsidizing someone else.
Right. You know what? What I think they ought to do is they ought to give us a flat tax of some percent, I don't know why, and then give you 10 categories, and you can choose what percentage of what you have to pay. You don't get any deductions, where it goes. And then, so then you don't have to feel bad that it's all going someplace, you know, you don't like.
But then are you allowed to use the services that are provided by the parts you haven't paid into?
Sure. And what happens is that...
Easy answer.
Yeah. Sure, why not?
Yes.
And if it just doesn't work out, then the next year they'll say, you know, let's move around. You can change your tune.
Well, let's move in.
Oh, then the government is required to spend the money on those. So if no one
right.
gives any money, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That would be fun to try for a few years.
The government can't divert funds.
Right, you can't move from
that. That would be interesting.
So accepting health is underfunded over here now.
Yeah. If you think defense is overfunded.
Funded, exactly. You just cut all these. I'm not going to spend through the funds.
Okay, well, tape ministry, let's roll. And I'm Rolf Engdahl. Yeah, I'm going to just start with a few words that I prepared, and then hopefully we can help each other out through this uncharted ground of house husbandry. My father is a Lutheran minister, and he worked hard and worked long, and considered childcare, like most of the men of his generation, considered childcare my mother's job. You know, my recollections of him in my childhood are as the primary disciplinarian, and several baseball games a year. And I recall one time when I aspired to be a little league pitcher that he and I went out and worked on my pitching one time, and which, you know, that when I think that's sad for me, but I think it's also very sad for him that he was so excluded from the family system and on the periphery. Whereas my mother was a homemaker, like many of the women of her generation, and raised five children and cooked and cleaned and, you know, shopped and did all those things that many of the women of her generation did, and many of the women of our generation are doing, along with a lot of other things. So that's kind of where I come from as a childhood models. I think I was 19 when I was exposed to some feminist perspectives, and I remember being disappointed with what my mom was doing with her life, and thinking, you know, because she's bright and she's articulate and she's good with people, and just thinking, oh, you know, what a waste, you know, that she's wasting her life as a homemaker. And I think that expression homemaker took on a negative stigma in the early days of you know, modern feminism that has become problematic in terms of what, you know, this latchkey generation that maybe Kurt Cobain of Nirvana represented so well. In the last 30 years, I think that the advances women have made in having many more choices than the women of my mother's generation have been, you know, important advances. A side effect of this, I think, is that less parents raise their children and more institutions do. I think as a society we've accepted the two working parent model as the norm and have devalued the work of parents in the home. Parenting and of making a home. And I guess what I'd like to do is challenge us to look at the division of labor in the home in ways that revalue the work of parenting and revalue the work of making a home. And I'm looking for help because, like most parents, I think I'm doing this by the seat of my pants and trying to rewrite the rules as I go along. So, I'm very open to experiences you've had, either your parents or your children or you yourself, in terms of how we can cooperate creatively as parents. It's in some ways I'm addressing a privileged group here, or speaking of a privileged group that I feel I'm in that there are two parents in my family, this is Karen. She's my partner, and she's married to a guy who doesn't work for a living. I think that, it's probably, I don't know if it's even the norm anymore for there to be two-parent families in the United States. I don't know the statistics on it, but I have a lot of respect for the single parents that are good parents, and I really am just astounded by how they can do it. Because I find that with two parents, it's a job, and we have only one and one on the way. I guess I'll share kind of my situation as a house husband. It's interesting, when I moved to Manson, which is a little town here on Lake Chelan, about 3 years ago, and not known for being a real progressive community. It's agricultural and tourist, and it's certainly not a Minneapolis or a Bellingham or a town like that where people are just looking for new ideas and new ways of doing things. So I would meet, Karen was employed at the public schools in Manson, so I would meet a lot of people through her, and then people would always wonder, well, what do you do? And what I would tell them, I'm raising Mary Morgan, who was two at the time, and I cook, and I shop, and I clean, and I teach some music lessons. And you'd see, when I said that, teach some music lessons, I'd see this visible relief on people's faces that they could attach something concrete thing that I did for a living. Then I got the sense that that's who I was in their eyes, because it was uncomfortable. And I think as much as, we talk about, changing roles, that a lot of people still, and probably myself to some degree, I'm sure myself to some degree, am not comfortable with the notion of a man as a homemaker, primarily, because of the messages that we've gotten so strongly. They have these sections in some newspapers that where they ask a certain question to six different people, and then they print the response to it. And a reporter once asked me a question. I don't remember the question, but and then I was supposed to tell what I did, and I said, well, I was a homemaker, and then she kind of pushed it a little further, and I did say, well, and I do teach and play some music, and then, of course, when it comes out in the paper, it's Rolf Vegdahl, musician. And if it was a woman asked that question, or if the woman moved to Manson and they asked, or if they asked Karen, what did you do, what do you do, and she said, I'm a homemaker, that would be the end of the questioning. That would be, and people would be comfortable with that. So I think,
or that she taught on the side for extra income.
Right, that she taught part
of her spending.
Right. She's a homemaker, and she substitute teaches a little bit, or something like that, whereas when it's me, when it was me saying, well, I'm a homemaker, or what do you do? I cook, I clean, I raise my child, and I teach some guitar lessons. I mean, they want to latch right onto that musician, because there's a comfort level with a man that's achieving, and I think We run a risk, I think, whenever we talk about gender roles and division, any of these kinds of discussions of grand generalizations, and I don't really know any way to avoid some of those in terms of how the difference between how most boys, how many boys are raised, and how many girls are raised, and we'll just have to live with those. And if any of us get too offensive in generalization, please let's correct each other. My partner, Karen, is a public school teacher and makes a professional income doing that. Some would say teachers don't make a lot of money. It's an adequate living, I think. I think some of the, our decision when we decided to have a child was that one of us would stay home during the early years. And we decided it would be me. And that was an exciting notion to me, intellectually, and emotionally too, because I know my connections with my dad were minimal as a child, and the idea of doing it differently and was exciting to me, which I think for, in some ways, when for a man to choose to be a homemaker has a whole different set of challenges than for a woman to choose that in this day and age. I think that the messages men have gotten, of course, are be a provider, be an achiever, move on a career track, be the boss, be the working person, and very clearly that's a message that men get. And so when we choose to make decisions that don't go in those directions, I think we end up with, even though we may be choosing them with full, with full certainty intellectually, or with some certainty intellectually, I think our feeling level often is like, oh, what am I doing? It's like if I teach 10 guitar lessons in a week for $12 a lesson, that $120, it means a lot to me. It means a lot more to me than, I don't know why. It's sort of on an emotional level. I have contributed monetarily to this household. And so I think we walk the kind of live in the state of cognitive dissonance, where my beliefs and my feelings aren't always the same. So I think that, and I don't know any way to undo that, but to still act according with my beliefs and hope that sort of brings the feelings along. I think it has to some degree. And the next thing is the next generation of children, if they see men and women interchanging, hopefully they more and more having, very similar roles in the household and in the outside the household workplace, that our children won't need to go through those struggles about. Now, I think when women choose to stay in the work in the home as opposed to outside the home, modern women, especially educated modern women, have had messages that say, don't just stay home, don't be just a homemaker. And you should be out there as part of the progression of women's choices and women rising to more power and more influence and more financial independence. And I think for modern women, they lack sort of that revolutionary edge that I can kind of claim, even though it's not a glamorous revolution, in the Safeway aisles. I think that in some ways, for women to choose to be homemakers now, there's probably this, am I just doing this because it's what my mom did, or am I doing this because, you know, it's what I'm programmed to do as a woman? Am I doing this in a subservient way because that's, you know, kind of what I was raised to do? I think the challenges are very different, I think, for men who are choosing homemaking than for women.
Yeah, you just said that you chose to stay at home, but you feel this need to contribute too, so you have guitar lessons. Mm-hmm. Well, there's women who choose to stay at home, even though they may be professionals, and they feel a need, like, oh, I really shouldn't be staying home, I feel guilty, I should be contributing. That works
right
now.
Yeah.
Now it does, because they have such complex put on staying home.
And because of the undervalue assigned to their work.
In the home, you mean?
In the home.
Right. Although I do think that the women that I know that are career track, 50-hour week women seem to suffer a lot more guilt about not being at home. And the realities are that women do the double day a lot more often than men do. That the woman that goes off and does a full-time job often comes home and makes dinner if the man is also working a full-time job. I think that double day, I mean, I think actually, you know, a missing piece of the feminist puzzle is for men and women together to make choices to change the way we divide labor, and I think with that, for me, it's just I see it as a freeing thing to be able to make the choice to be as connected with my daughter now as I am, and I can't imagine doing what Karen is doing and being away as much as she is, you know. I think it's opened up some areas of choice that for men and for women. I'm interested in hearing how you folks, I assume just your interest in this topic, you must have given some thought to different ways to approach parenting and partnerships yourselves, and I'd be real interested in hearing any creative steps that you've taken or are considering, or help me out here as much as you can, because I'm trying to figure it out myself. Otherwise, you'll just be hearing me talk and not.
I'm wondering about expectation as opposed to just choice. I mean, you're talking about the ways people feel internally with the choices that they make and their need to contribute. This is Cultural Diversity Week, so it's interesting. My wife is a Taiwanese woman, and her parents have a very interesting set of expectations on her and on her siblings. For them, there are maybe four reasonable occupations one might be in. You could be a doctor, and you could be an engineer. That's big in her family. You could be a lawyer, though that's not done nearly as much. And in my wife's family's case, a minister is okay, because they're very religious.
Are these expectations of her?
Of everyone that comes out of the family.
Okay.
And so, she went to Cal Berkeley, became an engineer. Her brother is an engineer. Her father's an engineer. I mean, they're all engineers. But the interesting thing is that once the two of us got together, there was a period of time when I was considering going back to graduate school to teach at the University of London. That would be an interesting thing to do for a while. And when we got wind of that, they told her, my wife, they said, well, quit your job and just, work at home, be a housewife and support your husband, because he's, and she had just gotten a degree at a very difficult school. And it just didn't seem to make any sense. They have a very hard time accepting in the first place that my business has nothing to do with engineering or medicine or being a lawyer or a minister. So it's a very strange kind of conflict for her, because they have this set of contrary expectations that you achieve a lot in order to be a good person, that that during high school and college it was always, how high are you up in your class, and so-and-so's, God is doing better than you, and you shouldn't allow that to happen. And then after that, it's this sense of, now that that's all done, you should just be the housewife. And they've bothered us my wife is pregnant now, and they've bothered us for a long time about that. We've been married 7 years, and it was, it became a very difficult thing, because, they were bribing us. They were, my sister, my wife has a sister and a brother, an older brother and a younger sister. And the older brother married a woman that her parents don't like, and she's too old to have children, they think. And so that's out. And they're not, probably won't have children. And then the younger sister doesn't particularly want to have children right now, if maybe ever. Her husband would really like to have children. So we'll see what happens there. And so, her mother would call up and say things like, okay, whoever has a child first, I'll buy a minivan. Well, that's just a bribe, an outright bribe. I don't know what is.
So you're still first in line now?
Yes, we're first in line for the minivan. I mean, I don't know. It's funny because I don't know what brand you have. Yeah, right, exactly.
Right.
I don't know what she's trying to do with that, and it's a very uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's right. They want grandchildren.
That's right. They want grandchildren. They want
to. It's not unnatural.
I think the I'm sorry. The expectations. I was kind of nervous about until I got to know Karen's parents better, and I just can't believe how accepting they are. I mean, I think from the parents of the woman in the relationship. Of that generation, you would expect, I would expect them to expect me to provide for their daughter, And even if they're progressive parents and progressive people, there's probably this underlying feeling that I should, whether they think it or not, I have experienced no pressure at all to do anything differently than we're doing. I'm just amazed. My father had some struggles with it early on, which I didn't know about. We talked recently, and he was, I was thanking him for helping us with down payment money, and he said, well, I it makes me a lot more enthused because I really want to support that you and Karen, what you and Karen are doing in terms of how you're raising your family, and that you're choosing to have one person stay at home, and he said, I had some trouble with who it was for a while staying home, he never criticized me for it, and I never even got, he's not, I wouldn't expect him to actually go, I'm having some trouble with. This is how I feel about this, so, yeah, it was, I think, I mean, it was a conflict for him, but it wasn't something that I sensed, and I can see how, especially for a man who's, for men and women who make choices similar to what we've done with Karen being the primary breadwinner, which is the great male buzzword, breadwinner.
And you're the bread maker.
Yeah, it's, that in many cases there would be strong feelings from the parents about, and I think in some ways the realities in the, especially if you're striving for, you know, long-term financial security, that the realities are that there is not equal pay for equal work out there, so that generally when push comes to shove and it's a man's career or a woman's career, men are going to be more capable of making more money because of the inequity in terms of remuneration for work. It's interesting that I always have thought about, you know, that men are supporting their family by going to work, you know, and then not long after we started this configuration, I realized that I was even using the words that, well, what I'm doing here is supporting Karen's school and then supporting Karen's work by being the support person that, you know, it here covering kind of this array of bases that that a person at home can cover to make life a little more tolerable for the person out there in the jungle of the workplace. But yeah, it's interesting.
Could you say, or maybe you did already, how you came to this arrangement, how long it's been, and what sort of Karen's half of the story at this point?
When we decided to have, I think it is. I think, you know, and I think in some ways, you know, just the dreams that, you know, Karen has known since she was young that she wanted to have a career. And,
well, I can get mine.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think, I don't know how unusual our situation is where I just have no capability. I have not honed any of my capabilities of the household. You know, I go in a grocery store and my mind goes blank. I probably fit some of the stereotypical husband things to a T. Rolf goes out of town and kind of go, oh God, what am I going to feed the kid? You know? So it works really well for us. I don't know how well it
worked. In your relationship, what's the old saw, something like the husband works from sun to sun, but the woman, is that reversed here? Do you work from sun to sun, and then Wolf works from dawn till he goes to bed at night?
Or, I think we both work from dawn till we go to bed, basically. And I think that
she doesn't come home and read the paper.
She comes home and she has a daughter.
I do envy my father in that, because he used to come home and we could not talk to him for half an hour. He got to, and I don't have that that protection.
We've worked on it.
Yeah, I've tried different things, you know, but.
To answer your question, Mary Morgan is 5 and a half, and pretty much from about the time she was 6 months old, about the beginning of that fall, we've been doing it this way. And it actually, you know, I remember at the time she was born, I was in school in a men's studies program, and you know, trying to look at alternatives to the traditional male being. And I was playing in a blues band, and I was working part-time, and I was coming home from school, studying about non-traditional male life, with maybe no energy and maybe a little leftover energy to be a father and a husband and, you know, basically just kind of going, you know. And it took about, 6 weeks of that for me to just go, I quit the blues band, I quit school, I kept a part-time job, and just, I remember thinking very clearly, I don't want to study this, I want to do this. And it's actually pretty, it's very satisfying to me now, that because I guess I consider myself a feminist, and I feel like this is an important step in terms of finding out new ways that men and women can be together and raise families and raise kids who feel like they have a lot of choices. And so I feel real, it's like I say, it's not a glamorous revolution. It's not marching in the streets of Chicago or anything like that. It's, you might try to get the Wrigley Field infield pattern on your living room carpet, when you vacuum or something. But it does feel good to be doing this. And I think in some ways it's an opportunity to break some of the rules of how homemaking is done too. Not that women don't have that opportunity and haven't seized that opportunity, but ironed clothes are a really low priority in our house. I think, and I just like, where do we get this notion that clothes have to be? Where do we get this? It was disgusting.
But you noticed that, didn't you?
Well, I didn't. Oh, I did only because I mentioned it. But and I think this might be dangerous ground to tread because I get into serious generalizing here. Men are raised to be more linear, more single-minded, pursue the goal, achieve, and less. And I think women have a lot more. I think that the context within which women see themselves is often more relational than the context within which men see themselves. And when you have an infant that you're with for the bulk of the day, your linear pursuits are gone. You basically are on response and in relationship for 6, 8, 10 hours at a time, and then you might be able to do something, some pursuit like get all the dishes done while the nap is on, and I think that for my mother and for many of the primary caregivers of infants, that's just been part of a reality, and I think it's been a part of the historical reality for many women, and for men who are doing that sort of thing, it's really a chance to grow. It's also a chance to just pull your hair out. But it's all good. What's that?
Growing hair.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that's true. I have a 5-year-old, so that's as far as I know in this adventure. And I only have one, and we'll have another one in a few months. And so I'll get to see that side of the picture. But it's ground that many men haven't been on to this degree. And in that respect, there aren't the kind of precedents that can either bind you or guide you. So, but I think, and especially in a population like at Holden Village, that there's a high percentage of very active fathers, and I don't want to just limit the notion to the primary house husband, but how do men enter the area of the home, whether one or both parents are working, whether it's the father or the mother, how do men enter into that realm creatively for everybody's gain? And
you know, my husband and I kind of fell into it naturally. I'm not sure just how it happened, because I grew up with a family of eight kids and we had dairy. So my mother chose to do the household things, and then all of us had to do the dairy things, right, plus the household. We had to do it all. Now, my husband grew up in a family of five kids. His father was the mill worker and his mother was a housewife. But when my husband and I met, we were together like for 8 years prior to getting married and starting our family. But we just fell into naturally sharing responsibilities. He always expressed wanting to be one who was home, raising the kids, doing the help. He loves to cook. He cleans much more meticulously than I do. And but there's always this machismo, you know, grew up with four older brothers. In a country where you hunt and all that kind of stuff.
He had no sisters?
He had one good sister, one little sister, my shooting boy. And he just fell into it naturally. We share all responsibilities. And like I said, he would choose to be home full time, but it realistically, it doesn't happen. So what's happened is we've become self-employed. We have our own business. We work together. But we can leave one or the other of us, and he can go to a school meeting if he chooses. He can go on a field trip, or he can run home and start dinner. I keep saying he because I appreciate him doing that. Mm-hmm. But that's what works for us, is we've come to a point in our lives where we can make those choices, and if he wants to go off and do something, he doesn't have to check that, you know, make sure you're in order, he can leave.
Right.
And I think he's real comfortable with not having to go through it. I'm sure you go through it every time you explain what it is you do.
All right. Right. Yeah, finally get to that profession.
Yeah.
See, this is the juncture that my wife and I are at since we have no children. And she's pregnant. And I work. I'm self-employed. I work in the home. I write music for a living, and it's actually a very there's actually an awful lot of work involved in doing it, and I find that I've already had to really strenuously deal with the and I'm the cook. Ruth does not cook. She, you know, just won't do it. Her way of getting me to do almost anything is to threaten to cook. It's an amazing thing. But I found that I pretty much do all the home stuff. The deal that first was I would cook and she would clean the dishes. After she got a dishwasher, that task seemed sort of unfair to me, but I'm not sure. And then a lot of the other stuff I just do because I'm around, and I find myself drawn, you know, to doing it because I'm in the home, and I can only shut the studio door so much. And if the phone rings, you know, I answer it. And when it's lunchtime, I make lunch for myself. And when it's, you know, so I find myself doing all this stuff in the house already. And when we have a child, I'm not exactly sure what is going to happen. Because I have to, I think it's, you know, you were talking about two-parent families, and I think the real reality is that people are just being paid so much less. It's very difficult, and in this Bay Area where we live, it's just, you know,
housing is really
housing is just terrible, and it's one of these really weird things that we grew up with this expectation that we would grow up and buy a house, you know, and buying a house in some ways is great. We have this place to live, and in the other sense, it's really horrible because it just ties up all this money, and so it means that we're always working because we always have to pay off this house. It's kind of a burden. And I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen when Ruth has a kid, and then we both have this child, and I'm home. I'm going to be home with it, I'm sure. You know, I guess my mother-in-law might, you know, just, you know, pay for a housekeeper to come in or something. I mean, she's so excited to have a grandkid. But I think realistically,
forget the man.
That's right.
The housekeeper.
That's right. That's right.
That's a good idea. Gosh.
Well, I'll take care of the first year.
18, yeah, we'll pay a lot of housekeeping.
Yeah. But I think I really would like to be part of that. And in fact, one of the reasons that I resisted having children for a long time is that when I was a youth, a teenager, I worked with child care, with an after school daycare center. I loved working with kids, and it's a real tempting thing to do. It's real easy, in a sense. It's real fun. It's enjoyable for me. And I can just see myself sort of letting go of this sort of highly competitive, I have to keep in contact with these advertising agencies all the time. And, it's one of the reasons I haven't come up here longer. I'd love to come up here for a winter thing. I just don't know how I would do it. It's very out of sight, out of mind business. And I'm very confused about what role is going to happen and how much, what's going to happen. My life is very much up in the air.
So your business doesn't allow you to work evenings. I mean, you can write your music.
I can do anything. I can do, my time is fairly free. In terms of contacting people, it's business hours.
Yeah.
But in terms of getting on the phone, I mean, I'm available a lot. And I have a line, and when I'm not on it, there's a way that people can get in touch with me, and there's all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, the reason when we first got together, I played piano for a living, and I would go to restaurants and play piano, and that was just terrible because it's nighttime. And the best thing about my job is that I can have my evenings free. I can play, or I can.
That might be over with for a while. That evening's free thing, for one reason or another.
I was going to say, do you think he's going to keep writing music after the kid comes?
I don't, I think that is one, another area that when we relook at all these things, is that, and I'm not saying your lifestyle is high on the hog, it doesn't sound like it is, but that to make choices to reduce the amount of work that families need to put out of the workplace does imply some, unless you're very lucky.
You can go ahead and say it.
Lifestyle
spend
changes.
Spend less.
Spend less money, yeah.
Lower your expectations.
And it might mean, I'm just amazed at it seems like in the middle class now, it's kind of assumed that the vehicle that has, that one would have would be one of these Range Rover type Jeep, one of these $25,000, I'm too old to backpack, but I can drive there, kind of things, any mileage generation has grown up. That we've accepted a lot of high ticket stuff, and that we assume that, $300 isn't much, but $300 a year for cable TV is just accepted as part of the cost of being in America.
Yeah.
And I think that, that for us, lifestyle choices are part of the formula.
Well, part of the thing with like a business, like for me, is that we put, money, an unbelievable amount of money into equipment.
Right.
And it's a self-perpetuating thing, to stay on top of things, you have to have a certain amount of equipment. And I'm trying to, my reasoning is that they buy music because of the way it's written, not so much because of the way it, because of the new cool sound. And so my hope is that I'm sort of at a point now where I can kind of plateau at buying equipment. I bought, two years worth of salary, for moving into equipment. And it's just a huge investment. And maybe that will slow down and stop. But it is a real question about priorities, about time, and exactly going to work out. My wife's schedule is somewhat flexible, and so there is some hope, you know, that she'll be, you know, the way she works is she needs to be in the office one day a week, and then she's out in the field a certain amount of time. The other amount of time she's doing reports and writing things, and so she can be home during that. So, I mean, there is some flexibility, but I'm worried about, you know, the, just sort of what's, and is my business just going to just decide to crumble, you know, away, fall away?
Yeah.
It sounds like you both have two full-time jobs.
We do.
Yours is located in your house, but that doesn't mean it's not your full-time job.
Oh, I'm well aware of that. It's really hard to get to the point where you're, I mean, I found myself, there was a period of time when I found myself working maybe 4 hours a day and doing house stuff the rest of the time, and just filling up my time, you know, and I'm trying to avoid that. I mean, there's so much that you can fill your time with, and it turned out that what I ended up doing for the career was getting rid of a lot of the stuff that's time-wasting stuff. You know, we stopped watching television, we stopped playing as much, and many games, and we used to really enjoy card games.
Keeps getting busier. It doesn't slow down, but you find lots of time to work it in. If your choice is to be with your children or helping in the household, you can find lots of time to do it. Like our choice is that we be together as a family at dinner time. That means coming home from work and taking that time, getting the kids to bed, and then my husband will go back to the store, say 10 o'clock at night, maybe work 3 or 4 in the morning, and then I'll get up at 6 in the morning. I'll get the kids going. It gives me 4 hours of sleep. But, you know, you make choices. There's enough hours in the day that if you want to do certain things with your family or accomplish things at home, well, maybe we're, because we are self-employed and we have more choices than most, but there's enough, we're finding that there's enough hours in the day because you don't need more hours to sleep.
I think the organization is the key. I don't know if that's a little planner book there. I know my wife and I each have one, and it's like we make appointments, you know, with each other or when our meetings or when we see our parents, and it's just so helpful.
Yeah.
It is challenging, though, to make appointments with a three-year-old.
Yeah.
Because the three-year-old may not, you know, it's like, it's the, oh, this section is reserved for quality time.
Bill. Oh,
yeah. Little Bill. And little Bill might not feel like quality time right then. He might feel like quality time at, you know, 9 at night, and when you have, you know, the whole parenting thing complicates it.
See, my kids are at the point now. One's she's 9, the other one's 12, mm-hmm. So it's getting easier in that sense. But you know, it worked out okay. I just work part time, and when I was working, he was home. When he was working, I was home. So. Mm-hmm.
I definitely applaud this style. I teach special ed, and I've taught in the South Dakota State Penitentiary. Now I teach in Wisconsin, and I see the kids who are missing, the, you know, families, whether if they have a single parent, it doesn't make any difference. Just any sort of family input into them, and discipline, love, whatever. And I value that so much. And the kids, you can just see how much better they're off when they come to school, you know, to see the teachers, because they don't get anything at home. And I want to do this for myself. My wife is a seminarian, and so I'm doing this now. We don't have children, but we're planning on them soon. You know, I come home, do my job, and then I cook and clean, and my wife goes to the seminary. And we hope to continue that, but I will, as soon as we have children, we're looking to start a business of our own, sort of an artist co-op in a farm that we have access to. And I can be home with the kids and kind of take care of this as well at the same time. Kind of be at the church and come back.
And your kids will see you work.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something that I saw my mom work my whole childhood, but I saw my dad preach. and I had to suffer through a couple years of confirmation class with him. But you know, just to that's something that as things have moved so far from agrarian life, or where the blacksmith shop was in the back of the house, you know, whatever, that children don't see their parents, which your child will see you work.
Did your father come from a liberal tradition?
No.
He came from a more evangelical or something?
Yeah.
Because my father's a Methodist minister and came from a liberal tradition, and the things you were saying about the way certain things were bad. I mean, I was just thinking it was interesting that you've gotten into this and your father's a minister. My father is.
So I was up there.
No.
No? Far from
it. And there's this interesting thing. My father, you know, wanted, I didn't realize this, you know, I didn't know, I have a very odd relationship with my father. He and my mother got divorced. He moved to Las Vegas. We were in Reno. He married another woman and who had a son that was named after him. And he was very excited that new chance he had at being a father, you know, gave him the opportunity. This child, you know, I just did music and stuff, and you know, I was bookish and you know, wore glasses. He was, and this new son was, you know, Little League, Pop Warner, you know, soccer, and the whole nine yards. And my father just expressed all the time, sort of oblivious to, you know, what I was saying, and, you know, the subtext of it. He would say, oh, you know, I just love, you know, having a son who goes and does all these sports, you know, all these things that he wanted. And so despite his sort of liberal theological perspective, he really had a straight idea, sort of conservative, traditional idea of what maleness was, you know, male action was.
And I think it operates on, you know, he probably intellectually has a pretty, you know, pretty wide open view of what maleness is, but I think it really operates so much on a feeling level. Like, you know, I think about what will it be like for me if we have a son. We have a daughter now. What certain feeling responses will I have because you know, she's a she and he's a he, and you know, best laid plans of raising them equally, and you know, think of the stigma of tomboy and the stigma of, well, it's not even really a stigma, tomboy anymore, but the stigma of sissy is huge. I mean, there's no more humiliating thing for a boy or for even a man than to be labeled sissy. And
you know, tomboys are achievers.
Right.
Yeah. They're kind of overachievers.
Very feminist. Right.
Right. Yeah. And I think with our Mary Morgan, you know, we were very conscious of, we forbade pink and frill for the first, you know, 9 months. I think after 9 months, boy, she was the first granddaughter on my side after many grandsons. And they were just all this impulse. They're like, oh, good, we can give her the fruit. And
pent up cuteness.
Yes, pent up frills and petticoats, you know. You know, but so we were very conscious of the difference between when she dressed somewhat like a girl, the sort of responses she'd get from a stranger on the street would be, oh my, are we finicky? If she was wearing something, you know, more androgynous, it would be, hey, what's beefing you? You know, to the same sort of thing. And I know that if we have a boy, I'm not going to put him in a dress. Partly because
it's easier to change diapers,
right? You know, I mean,
my photograph of my grandfather when he was 1.5 years old, he's in a long white lace dress because back then, you know, children, they were children's clothes rather than male clothes or female clothes.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that, and why wouldn't I put him in a dress? One, because I just, it would just feel too weird to me to do it. I mean, honestly, this, that would just feel too weird to dress a boy in a dress. Whereas to put Mary Morgan in sweats or whatever, you know, I mean, there's,
overalls.
You know, it's like, oh, that's great. You know, and I was kind of happy when people would think she was a boy. Or maybe it's because we, because boys are, you know, it might be because there's sort of this conscious rejection of a position of privilege that males have had in our culture, that if man chooses, and so men in drag, that's a reality. What's women in drag? Well, we don't. There's really no such thing, right?
But have you ever seen a baby, let's say a bald-headed baby boy with one of those little ribbon things on top of their head, which women put, or families put on their little girls who don't have much hair, so they put this little ribbon thing with the string. I've never understood that.
No, I know. I couldn't believe it when my friends had a baby, because it was so important to the baby's mom, and she was really bothered when people were mistaken their daughter.
Yes, I think all parents do that.
My daughter's used, because she thought about how a little boy helped her.
What happens when they get like baby?
Yeah.
Well, a friend of mine who was at Corvallis at school, he made great effort to raise his daughter, both he and his wife. She's an engineer and has a PhD, and he was working on his master's degree in computer science. And they really had planned all the time that they were going to treat whatever the sex was just identically. They didn't care. And, I mean, this little girl had... She had all the toys that I loved to play with her toys at her house. It was great stuff. It wasn't Barbie dolls. And she had some of that, and she played quite equally. And when she was five, they were getting her a daycare, someone to come into the home for a while. It was just going to be convenient for the summer, I think. And they wanted her to meet her. And so the woman came, and they all talked. And when she left, they said, well, what did you think of her? And John tells the story all the time. He said, the little girl looked up at her mom and said, she had beautiful shoes. And he said at that point, he thought, okay, it is nature, not nature. There's nothing I can do, you know? It was startling to him, because they'd never heard anything like that out of her.
That's right. They were like a really slippery.